Hey, what's up, Trainiacs? Taryn here with co-host NTK. We are exactly 1 week after Kona, and we figure we might as well do a Kona roundup. There were a lot of stories that came out of the pro race and kind of just the week of Kona. So I thought we'd sit down here and recap a lot of the stories that I want to talk about. We got NTK. What is, before we get into a lot of the stories that I want to talk about, what's your take on Kona? How'd you like it?
Oh, man. So good. Everyone who is into triathlon needs to go to that. Just, you know, I mean, we've been before, but it's just magical. And I know that sounds cliche and stuff, but it really is kind of this magical week. And there's a special feeling the whole time you're there leading up to it. And race day is just, you can't even imagine it. If you've never experienced it, you can't imagine it. It's so great. Take a vacation. Go see the Ironman in Kona.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. We went there back in 2013 for the first time for our honeymoon. I totally hijacked our honeymoon. And when we were on the way there, like in the month leading up to it, you were like, yeah, well, we're going to Kona, and Taryn picked our honeymoon. And then after that week, you're like,
that's amazing. We have to go every year.
Kona's the best place.
Yeah. It's pretty great.
Yeah. We feel really lucky to have been able to go there. And to be perfectly honest with you, I got pretty teary eyed as Patrick Lang came across the finish line, not because of the race, but it was like a combination of the race being as special as it was, having two course records broken, the bike course record and the overall course record, being there for that. And then like the fact that 4 years ago when we went there, we were there as like an aside. We had to save up money for it. And it was something that I did off to the side when we had time to take time away from work. And now
triathlon, you mean?
Triathlon.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now the fact that it is work, and that work is me standing on a media stage with ripped off sleeves and board shorts, and that's work now. And that work is real life, and real life is triathlon. And like it was kind of touching that in that 4 years life has changed so much, and it was cool to be there on that day. And I'm very grateful that all of the followers are basically what allow me to do it. So thank you all. Thanks, followers.
Thanks, Trainiacs.
Yeah, Trainiacs are good people. So let's get into some of the stories that happened that race day. It was a special day. NTK is going to take part where she can because she was there doing the Instagram stories, if anyone followed. But let's chat Ironman Kona.
So probably the biggest story was the winner of the men's race, Patrick Lang.
Lange. I got beaked hard in the YouTube comments because I was saying Lang.
Right. Lange.
But, yeah.
Okay. So Patrick Lange won, and that was only his fourth Ironman, which is amazing. If you watched him run that race, he looked so good, so fresh on the run, and that's only his fourth Ironman. That's crazy to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he grew up in Europe racing short course and getting a lot of speed. And then it was early in 2016, apparently, that he did his first race in which he qualified for Kona. Comes to Kona last year, breaks the run course record, makes it onto the podium. And then he still have to, when you finish high in Kona, you basically have to just go and validate your spot and finish a race the next year to get your spot in Kona. It's not like an automatic. We have Petey here guarding us from leaves outside. Easy, bud. Easy. So you have to go and validate your spot. It's not an automatic entry for the rest of your life. He went and validated his spot in early 2017, and thus Ironman Kona 2017 was only his fourth Ironman.
And that's just wild.
Yeah, yeah.
Many people spend their lives training to get to this thing, to qualify for this thing, right? Like years and years.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing about that I take as a really big indication of how special that is that he hasn't had years and years of time in the saddle. So if you don't know, Patrick Lange, he basically wins it all entirely on the run. He came out second pack in the swim, second pack in the bike. He's not a phenomenal biker. He had to move up from 10th place and 11 minutes all the way up to the lead. So he basically won the entire race on the run. And what that tells me is that he has a long way that he can still go and improve in the sport, because he doesn't have decades of bike fitness experience. He's got it in short course, but he hasn't yet built it in long course. Hence, if he spends a bunch of time on the bike, there's a ton of room for improvement. Pair that with his awesome run skills, and you could have a guy that could be breaking his own record next year and his own record again the year after. And he's still young, where a lot of really top-notch Ironman athletes don't reach their peak until 34, 35. We're talking about a guy that could basically set a new standard for speed in Ironman, like Tiger Woods did in golf, and everyone else has to start chasing him and bringing, like, basically just flat out regular marathon speed to marathon and Ironman speed. So I think that it wasn't necessarily a dominant performance where he's beating people by 10 and 20 minutes, but I think it's a performance that gives indication that sets a,
he potentially could eventually beat them by 10 and 20 minutes.
Yeah, and he could potentially set a new standard that mentally it's like breaking the 4-minute mile in running, that people go like, holy smokes, all of a sudden, if I'm going to step up to the Ironman course distance, I got to be running 240 or better off the bike. And we saw little glimpses of that being the new expectation. So yeah, that was big.
And what's his way back background? Like, why is he such a freak of nature?
He's just built for it. You look at his stride in running and it's natural. He's thin, he's light, he's upright, his structure is built for running really well. He's not like Lionel Sanders, where he's a big muscular guy. So that allows him to be efficient and fluid and do well in Kona, because he's not pushing this big machine and having a huge sweat rate. So as long as he stays cool and he's allowed to stay, or he can keep himself strong enough that he doesn't break down towards the end of a marathon, he can keep that running pace and that fluid running stride for 26.2 miles, which he did.
I think the next few years of Kona are going to be very interesting, with Jan Frodeno, Sebi, now Sanders, and Lange. It's going to be quite the competition for the top. Like, I think it's going to be a very fun race to watch in the next few years.
Well, and I think in that time, you're also going to have guys like Javier Gomez coming in.
Your favorite.
Javi.
He's your little guy.
Yeah. Fellow,
he's a little guy like you.
Little muscular dude. Him coming in. Basically, all these ITU athletes coming into it with a really big base of speed.
It's going to change the game.
Yeah. It's going to be dangerous.
Well, and so speaking of different people with speed and different things coming into it, the super bikers were not really able to dominate the field this time. It doesn't seem like that even works anymore. Jan Frodeno beat Sebi, Lange beat Sanders.
You've got now, as opposed to say 10, 12 years ago, you would have guys like Norman Stadler coming in. Even just 4 years ago, I think it was when Sebi came in and just dominated, crushed the bike, and was a good enough runner to hold people off. But now you're getting super bikers that year after year are trying to come in, dominate the field, beat up on the main contender, hold the main contender like Jan Frodeno off on the run. And they haven't been able to do it for a number of years. They beat up on Jan enough, and we'll get to Jan towards the end, but they beat up on Jan enough to take him out. But that could have been something with his body structure, could have been just an off day, could have been something nutritionally. But year after year, what we're finding is the runners are coming in, and unless you have one of the fastest runs on the day, Daniela had the fastest run on the day, Patrick Lange had the fastest run on the day, and consistently they're winning. And you can see that down in ITU, that it's not a swimmer's race, it's not a biker's race, it's a little bit more biker's race in this full distance, but you have to back that up with a really strong run.
So with Lionel Sanders, I mean, there was a lot made of him before the race. There was quite a bit on YouTube talking about his training style, his work ethic, all the sort of the strange quirks he's bringing to the sport. He's doing things differently than a lot of other people. He's also super analytical. You know, he's bringing a whole different thing to this, and he's been on the podium before, and he was almost on the top of the podium this year. which kind of proves this point that you've made in the past, which is you've got to be on the podium before you're going to win.
Yeah, I heard over the course of the week that when they were talking about Sanders not winning, they said something like, you've got to be on the podium before you're on the top of the podium. Because Kona is a different beast. Kona is a race that we're chatting with Bob Babbitt throughout the week, the guy that's been in the sport since 1980. And he says that in the top 25 guys, you've probably got 25 guys that have been top 10. And they could go anywhere from 5th to 20th because it's such a deep field. And there are so many things that you've got to figure out in Kona. And this being Sanders' just second time, he approached the race in 2016 as if he had to train immense amounts. And he did 13 days that were 7.5 hour plus days in 2016, overcooked himself, got to the race, was tired. This year he went the entire opposite way, didn't really do any days besides I think one that was 7.5 hours. And the second he felt fatigue in 2017, he gave himself 2 days off completely and then another 2 days of rest. So he came in entirely different. He's figuring, and then this year has a phenomenal race, but was like running like a rusted up lawn chair would move. And what he said was he figured out that after the race, he was eating potato chips and Gatorade. And as soon as he started getting electrolytes back into his system, he could move again. He thought that he wasn't going to be able to walk for days. He was so sore. And all of a sudden, 3 hours after the race, he's like, I can walk.
He's got his full range of motion back.
I can walk. Yeah. I feel fine. Everything's good. Next day, wasn't sore. So to him, he's learning that it wasn't a physical issue. It wasn't a training issue. He's got to now figure out the nutritional issue. And that's kind of the thing about Sanders, that he goes at it like a freaking nut job, that he trains like he doesn't see the light of day. He does swimming either at the pool, or now he's got an endless pool in his basement that he's built, and he looks at himself in a mirror swimming. He does pretty much all of his riding on rollers or on a trainer on Zwift indoors with this sound system booming right in his face. And I think he's got away from a lot of the treadmill work because he's realized they need some of that side-to-side body structure stability. And he's doing a fair bit more running outside. But if you look at Sanders in any interview, he says that he's analyzing during a race what went wrong, what can he improve upon. And I think that incredibly analytical mind and that attention to all 100 points of detail that have to go into winning Kona. It's like Team Sky in the Tour de France. They looked at 1% marginal gains in every single aspect of that sport. And Sanders is kind of approaching triathlon like that. And I think just like Patrick Lang might be setting a new standard for the speed that needs to be brought to the marathon, Sanders might be bringing a new standard for the dedication and the analytics and the attention to detail that is brought to Ironman. Now, personally, that kind of makes me sad, being somebody that when I was in professional curling, because the Olympics came around in curling and all of a sudden there's so much money in it, and the reward for being at the top of the world was so much greater than being, in my case, just 15th ranked in the world where there was no reward. It was like we made $2,000 a year. It took so much of the fun out of it. It took a lot of the camaraderie out of it. And I'd be sad if that is what happened to triathlon, that a lot of the raw realism got taken out of it because everyone started taking it so seriously that every single aspect of the sport became a life or death decision that you're constantly analyzing. But
isn't it already kind of like that though? I mean,
I think triathletes by nature, yeah, are very A-type.
No, but
and
even
analytical.
Even in the pro ranks, I mean, this doesn't, to take it to that level that he has, that's one thing, and he's a little bit of an outlier as a person. But I mean, I feel like the pros have been working like this for a long time.
Yeah, I would say that they're a very fickle bunch. I think triathlon by nature is a very fickle sport. I think if anyone has seen one of my vlogs, they would know that I think that for the average age grouper and probably the average pro, one of personally, I think a really good approach is to look at it as how can you stay in the sport longer as opposed to being successful in 1 year or 2 years. And I think that that overly analytical mindset is what can lead to mental burnout. And treating it more as like a, how can I make this part of my lifestyle that I enjoy every single minute of? I don't think you can take that 100% analytical mindset to it. I think Lionel can do it because he's fulfilled by seeing himself in a mirror and seeing, oh, there's a flaw. Watch me fix it on the next stroke. Like that's how he gets his jollies. I don't think most people can function like that. And I think that that's something that can lead to burnout. So that's why I'd be sad if that analytical mindset started, especially if it started trickling down to the age groupers. I mean, pros, if they can do it, more power to them. It is their life. But age groupers take their cues from pros. And if that becomes the trend in pros, all of a sudden age groupers are going to say, oh, that's what I got to do. And we're already an annoying A-type bunch of people who can't go out past 8:30. And for that to even increase more, I think that would make me sad.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of somebody else who operates like a machine, on the women's side, Daniela Reef, it seems like she can kind of do whatever she wants on the course and she's going to be A-okay.
That was very interesting. Yeah. Leading into the race, I went and watched the pro press conference, and even just watching Daniela Reef sit down was like ice. She was purposeful. She was focused. She didn't chat a lot with the people around her. She was there to win. She wasn't there to have fun with the press, or at least my perspective. I mean, maybe it could just be, could be that she's shy, could be that she's not too chatty, but she looked so focused. So going into it, I thought that she was going to be tough to beat because she's like a machine. And the thing about Daniela's race that it makes me wonder who can ever beat her. She was 5 minutes back at 140 kilometers into the bike. She has 40 kilometers left, and 5 minutes is a huge deficit. She decides that for the last 40 kilometers of the bike, she's going to time trial it. Go as fast as she can, leave nothing else on the bike. Basically, bike it as if she didn't have to run after. She goes and gains 10 minutes on Lucy Charles, the leader, at 140 kilometers in 40 kilometers. So this is like, let's say I were to do a 40 kilometer time trial in an hour. Somebody that's doing it in an hour and 10 is basically in another league altogether. Like that 10 minute gap is huge. Like that's a different caliber of athlete. And she's probably doing it at under an hour. Lucy Charles is doing it 10 minutes slower in that last 40K. And then in addition to that, Reef comes and does the fastest female run split on the day. So she leaves everything that she can in that last 40K of 180K ride and then still has the legs to run after it. Now, I'm not really taking a stance on this because I don't think it's my place. I don't know enough about her or the pro field, but there were people that I was talking to while we were in T2 that were giving off the splits, and they said that they thought she was doping because of that performance.
Doesn't get talked about a lot, not openly in this sport. I mean, it does in other sports like cycling. It's obviously for obvious reasons, it's spoken about a lot, but you don't hear much about it in triathlon, or at least not.
No,
sort of from the outside of it, you don't.
No, you don't hear about it a lot. One thing that I will say is a friend of mine who was getting into the high ranking junior development ranks of triathlon. He said that it becomes so apparent that it's an option very quickly early in your career because the risk of doping is, okay, well, you get caught and you're out of the sport. The reward or the risk of doping or the risk of not doping is that you're out of the sport anyway, and you know that you're out. So it's the same risk.
Because you can't do well enough.
Because you can't do well enough. And when you're a junior and your life is completely focused on being the best that you can in the sport, it's like you have no option. And the reward of potentially doping is that you can keep getting better. So he just said on a risk reward scale, okay, risk of doping is that you get caught and you're out of the sport. Risk of not doping is that you know that you're out of the sport 100%. And the reward of not doping is personal satisfaction, but the reward of doping is potentially that you can be the best in the world. So he's like, just on a grid of risk reward, like you're almost left with no choice. Now, I don't know enough about the pros. I don't know enough about that situation. I don't know enough about them. I don't know enough about Daniela to say one way or another. But her dominance right now is kind of leading people in transition, and she's jacked. Like, she is so jacked. But to be able to do a 40K time trial and then pull out the fastest run in the field, it's either so incredibly dominant that she is that genetic freak of nature, or it's going to lead to people saying, like, this is a little bit too much.
Well, that's interesting that Lange, in his only his fourth Ironman, could have that kind of dominant performance, could pass Sanders on the, you know, all of that. Nobody's rumbling about him juicing, but Daniela Ryf, on the other hand, mm-hmm. everyone's rumbling about her juicing. What's the difference?
I think that the difference is, in her case, she's crushing fields. She's killing fields by 10, 20 minutes in some cases. Yeah, that's hard to say. And frankly, I don't really have an opinion on it that's strong enough, because I don't have enough knowledge to say one way or another. What I will say is that I think that in most sports, as we've seen with recent documentaries like Icarus, like, it's probably more common than we think.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So take her out of the equation. Mm-hmm. We've got Lucy Charles, 24 years old. So is she going to be Ryf's competition coming up here?
Well, you know what? I chatted about that with Coach Pat, and I said, it's got to be clear that she's the one knocking at the gate. And he said, well, to be that good that quickly, does that mean that you overcooked yourself and
that young?
Yeah, because normally it's not until you're 30, 35, 38, we're even seeing.
Sport, yeah.
Yeah. When you're young, you've got speed. When you're old, you've got endurance. It takes a long time to build endurance. So that's why you see folks like Craig Alexander, that is setting course records in his late 30s. And I think he was 40 when he set the previous course record. You see Jan Frodeno graduating out of ITU and then going into long course. Lucy Charles goes from Olympic hopeful for Great Britain in swimming, takes that big engine, goes into Ironman and triathlon racing, and all of a sudden is fantastic at long course. And she's doing that without having a big base of endurance behind her. Well, I mean, she's got a huge engine, so she has a big base of endurance, but not like decades of endurance. So that tells me one of two things. My opinion originally was that, holy smokes, she is an endurance freak, and we're going to see her setting records and winning for decades, because she's just so built for this race that she needs a few more years of training for it. Coach Pat, however, comes in and he says, well, did she maybe just... she built up so quickly because she was the swimming freak of nature that we see a lot of people that get really quickly, really fast, really quickly, and then they taper out because they did too much too soon. So can she keep on that trajectory of getting faster? He said, well, I mean, that's a really big question. It's not as simple as she's 24. She did really well.
Her best years are still in front of her.
Yeah, it's not as simple as that. Right. It's, can she keep getting faster and stay injury free? Because she's still young. And when you're young, you're fairly immune mm-hmm. to injuries. All of a sudden you turn 30 and your back hurts and your feet hurt and you got a sore ankle like me. And like, you know, it's not as simple as she's the next thing.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the day didn't look hard for her or Ryf or Lange. It looked really hard for Sanders. But I mean, we were out there on the course and that was a hot one. That was a scorcher. It was tough for us. Never mind. I honestly, truly watching these people compete, the pros and the amateurs, it was mind-boggling to me to think about being running out on the lava fields when I was walking around or bicycling around and I could take shelter and stop for a few minutes and sit under a tree if I had to.
If there was shade, you found it.
Yes, right? Which a lot of people had to. I mean, it was 42 degrees. Well,
you're like a little Mexican construction worker, just finding the little patch of shade.
Hey, man.
That's for me.
But no, really, I mean, anybody out there, anybody would need that as just even a spectator. It was felt like 42 degrees Celsius with the temperature and the humidity. And there was not a cloud in the sky. That sun was absolutely scorching. And yet these folks are out on the lava fields for hours, right? Like it boggles my mind that they can do this and survive. But actually there was a fairly high, did not finish rate, I guess, among pros.
Yeah. I don't know.
High-ish.
I know that there were a lot of pros that had really hard days. Jesse Thomas, he was having a race that was going exactly according to plan. And then I think it was the last 16 miles. Basically, he walked and was complete disaster.
Sebastian Keenley. Gosh.
Yeah, he had a hard finish. Our buddy that we did the last podcast with the night before, John Joseph, he was looking for about a 12 and a half hour. He did 14:40. But then on the flip side of that, you've got records being broken in the bike and the run. I talked to an age grouper, Trainiac buddy that I made down there, Oliver Harkins, I believe, from Ireland. And this is a guy that trains in no hotter than 20 degrees Celsius, call it 72 degrees Fahrenheit weather. And he had the race of his life. He went under 10 hours. He did 9:59:34, I think. But I asked him, I said, was it an easy day or a hard day? And he said, you know what? It really depended on the time of day because of how the winds go. And the winds switch around so much in that course, apparently, that if you get out early enough, it can be calm and you can go and you can smash the bike. And then it's still not blazing hot out there. And there's a little bit of air movement in the morning for the pros. However, you get just a little bit later and maybe it could be 20 minutes later and you're dealing with winds that are in your face going out, in your face coming back. You've got hotter weather later in the afternoon. You've got to deal with more heat for a longer period of time. And he said that I think the do not finish rate for the age groupers is basically right where it was. So it's not like it was an easy day or a hard day. And I think that goes to show that I think the conditions in Kona are so much more difficult than anyone gives them credit for, that it's not just you're racing the course, you've also got to race the conditions. So to compare 2 years ago performances to this year kind of performance and say, Patrick Lang just had the best day that's ever happened in Kona. Well, you know what? It could be the best performance paired with the best conditions. You just don't know. It's like one of those courses that it's almost like racing on a different course year to year. So is that race any better? Is that performance any better than last year's performance by Jan? Who knows? Maybe Jan's was even better. But maybe Daniela and Lange just threaded the needle just right.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Something that has often crossed my mind is that it doesn't seem like it actually matters how well you do in the swim, because you've got, I mean, it, not that it doesn't matter, but Josh Amberger coming out of the water very dominantly.
Yeah. 2 minutes ahead of everyone.
Yeah.
I think it was, or a minute and a half.
Lucy Charles, mm-hmm. Lauren Brandon, another name people might know, but yet that doesn't seem to make a difference to what the end of the race is going to look like.
Yeah, I think what you see is that Josh Amberger, he goes out, he does well in the swim. Same with Lucy Charles, same with Lauren Brandon. They get a lead. And the only benefit that I can really see is that you don't have to, being out in front, you don't have to go and cook yourself on the bike to catch up to the leaders. Lionel Sanders and Sebastian Keenley, they've got to go and push massive power to make up that 4.5-5 minute difference being in the second swim pack. Daniela Reef has to do that 40K time trial to catch up to Lucy Charles and Lauren Brandon. And they've got to cook themselves a little bit and burn a few more matches on the bike But when it comes right down to it, the swim is only, well, what is it? It's like 10% of the overall time spent in the race. The bike is more than 50%. The run is 30 to 40% of the entire time spent in the race. And this even trickles down to some of the numbers that I've seen when I started analyzing ITU, that you can come out of the water in front. And, you know, they always say that you can't win the race in the swim, but you can certainly lose it. I almost don't even see that, because you've had people like Marinda Carfrae, Sebastian Keenley, that come out minutes, like 5, 6, 7 minutes down, and they've got so much time to make up for it that, you know, you look at Lucy Charles, she had to back up that swim performance with an awesome bike and an awesome run. Lauren Brandon backs it up with an awesome bike, but then she finishes like third last because she had the slowest marathon. So yeah, like congratulations, you came out of the water in first, and whatever they call it in cycling, that you get the preem bonus from your swim sponsors, if that's a thing in triathlon, and I'm sure there is. But you can't judge who's going to win the race based off of who's coming out of the water in the front.
They should put the swim at the end so you can cool off after all that biking and running.
Yeah, I'm sure that they would appreciate that.
It's my suggestion.
I think they used to do that back in the 80s.
And when people died from drowning.
yeah, get a cramp in the swim. That's enjoyable.
No, I just think it should go at the end, like cool off after that day. Have a nice leisurely swim to end your race. No?
Yeah, no, not quite.
I don't know. Nobody asked me, but I think it's a good idea. You were talking earlier about Lionel Sanders and how he's now not running as much on a treadmill because he needs that sort of outdoor feeling, you know, to get his body going side to side, et cetera. Is that the same for the bike? Because it sounds like a lot of the pros are actually, more pros are doing more cycling indoors as opposed to getting outside to cycle.
Well, what I found when I was at Interbike a month before Kona actually happened is I was chatting with Wahoo, and we see Zwift down there, and there's a lot of tech going into indoor cycling, lots of money going into it. And you see little bits of people over the last few years in, say, your crit races locally, or a few people here and there that are starting to do more and more training inside. And notably in this race, Sebi does a ton of training indoors in his condo in Germany, I think it is, back home. Jan, over the last few years, about 3 years ago, he took a big leap up in how strong his bike was. And apparently that was when he committed to doing a lot more training inside. Lionel barely sees daylight. Like I say, he does almost everything on Zwift. And Lucy Charles is also a Zwifter. And what the it's kind of the sentiment was when I was in Interbike is everyone was saying that it's more purposeful time spent. You're not going to go and do a workout outside and you've got traffic to contend with and start and stop or wind in your face. And let's say in my case, I'm trying to do certain specific intervals out here training for Half Ironman Austin, and I'm supposed to hold 210 watts for 30 minutes. Well, if there's wind, that 210 watts goes up to 235 and then down to 185 and then up to 240 and then down to 215. And it's just all over the map. And in addition to that, I'm out here training on the prairies where it's just bald prairies, no incline whatsoever. But the training bikes out here right now, I just picked up the Wahoo Kicker a couple days ago, and pair that with the Wahoo Climb that's going to be coming out, I can load up Half Ironman Austin's bike course and I can do the exact bike course with the exact resistance and the exact grade of my bike going up and down. And all of a sudden, I don't have to start and stop for traffic. I don't have to start and stop for flat tires. I don't have to take 20 minutes to put on a helmet and get my flat repair kit and all the nutrition that I need stuffed into my jersey pockets. So you're seeing a ton of athletes that are starting to spend more time on the bike indoors than they are outdoors. Now, the thing that I've always wondered about that is those first few rides outside where we're getting out in the spring after the winter, that it feels like hell because
lung butter
and like the sides of my back are so sore because I don't have that crosswind. Well, what I'm finding, just looking at the results of who has excellent bike fitness out there, it's a lot of people that spend a lot of time indoors and a small portion of it outside. So
maybe they're doing strength exercises to work on their back muscles.
I almost guarantee that they are. Or actually, you know what? I think Lionel Sanders doesn't, and he's jacked. He is completely jacked. So he's naturally strong dude. I think over the next 6 months, I'm certainly going to be experimenting with doing a lot more purposeful training indoors and not having it just be like my junk miles that I do in the winter. It certainly seems like there's something to it that some of the strongest bikers are doing a lot of time indoors.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It was also interesting that that Kona seemed huge. You know, there's so many people watching, so many people competing. I mean, it's a giant event. It's hard to believe that the USAT president is coming out saying the sport of triathlon is stagnant. I mean, it doesn't seem that way when you're at Kona. But maybe it is in the lower ranks. I don't know. Is the sport stagnant?
Certainly seems like it to me. I have thought that locally here for a few years, that it's seeming like the races are getting smaller and smaller. And I hear about, say, back in smaller and smaller and certainly less competitive. Apparently back around late 90s, early 2000s, you would have six or seven guys here locally that would be battling it out for going sub 205 in an Olympic distance. Now you've got one or two. You've got Pat Peacock, you've got a high performance kid that's doing it. You know, maybe somebody comes in from out of province that can do it, maybe. But, you know, for the longest time, if Coach Pat would go and race a 202, he was guaranteed to win for the last like 15 years. However, and that's kind of what I'm seeing when I was on the board of our local triathlon association, we were kind of seeing numbers that, you know, the numbers were basically the same for people that the absolute numbers of memberships held throughout the year, but it was more one day racers that would come and do one triathlon and they wouldn't do a bunch
locally.
Check
it off their bucket list and they're done.
Check it off their bucket list or they're just not racing here like me.
Oh yeah.
So yeah. I raced once locally this year, just once. Mm-hmm. Did a little tune-up race, but it's not my main race. Like Pat and I, we basically did this local race for data, not to actually do a purposeful race here. And then I go elsewhere. And I go elsewhere and I spend my dollars with the World Triathlon Corporation and Ironman. Mm-hmm. So I think what we might be seeing, that I'm not yet sure how I feel about it, is that Ironman at the half distance and the full distance is gobbling up triathletes, and that's where the vacuum is going. So the local races are suffering.
Right. The sprints and the Olympics.
The Olympics and the grassroots sports that bring people in. And instantly people are moving up to halves and full Ironmans.
Well, you see that in the comments on your YouTube channel, is that people are saying, hey, I've signed up for my first ever triathlon. It's, you know,
half Ironman
so Austin and so. Or full Ironman, whatever. And it's wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, what I always say, a lot of people get in my face literally my digital face, and say, you know, how dare you look down at your nose at people who aren't approaching the sport the same way you are. Maybe they just want to finish the race. You know what? I look at triathlon and endurance events as a test of what you're capable of. It's an opportunity to get yourself out of comfort and see what your mind and your body is capable of. And if you want to learn if you can finish a race, I can answer that question for you. It's yes. There is so much time that you have to swim, bike, and run in those cutoff times in a half Ironman and a full Ironman that it's not much of a challenge to go and finish one. Mm-hmm. I believe that the challenge, and this is how I approach it, and it's not to say that I'm approaching it right, but this is just what I believe, that the challenge is How fast can you do it? What is your body capable of? Can you train enough and stay healthy enough and stay dedicated enough to race your best race? Can you? Mark Allen said it when we interviewed him. He said he wanted to know how well he could make his body move mm-hmm. in time mm-hmm. and space.
Yeah.
And I mean, disrespectful to the sport might be very strong, but I think that you're cheating yourself out of finding out what you're capable of by just seeing if
doing
you can finish it.
Doing the hardest possible thing.
Just doing the longest possible thing just to say that, yes, you did it.
Well,
I think the saying, yes, you did it, and you got the most out of your body that you possibly could, I think that's a challenge.
If a lot of people go in and do the full Ironman as their first, and it's their one and only because it hurts so much. It was such a long day. It was so much. They never do another one again. As opposed to you do a sprint, which is still going to be hard. I mean, I remember, you know, your earlier days and being around people at local races, run into an old friend or an high school friend or whoever who just did that sprint for the first time and they thought they were going to die in the sprint. Mm-hmm. But it was not so hard that they were never going to do it again. And thus it became lifestyle because it was something I got a taste of it and I want more and I want to do better next time and I can do better next time and I have the time to devote to the training because it's not as exhaustive to train for a sprint as it is to train for a half Ironman or full Ironman. And then, you know, they're into the community. They are in the sport for a period of time. Whereas so many people that we seem to hear from through your channel, it's a one and done because they did an Ironman first.
And it it also becomes something that you take a baby step and mm-hmm. then you can take another baby step and you can take another baby step and you can see progress mm-hmm. in the two half Ironmans that I've done. I figured out some things in the first. I thought that I learned from them in the second. What I learned in the second is that Taryn does not do well in heat after mm-hmm. being in Winnipeg winter mm-hmm. all winter for my training. I learned something there. And we learned.
We got to Lionel Sanders it up. We got to build a sauna that you can
we do
run
in
the basement.
Yeah, we got to do that. but if, let's say if I were to just go and, I mean, I could finish a full Ironman tomorrow, easy, but
not
probably
easy. Not
probably
easy.
Well, it'll be a tough day, but I know I could do it. But what would probably happen is if I jumped all those little baby steps, what would happen is I'd go and I'd do like a 12-hour Ironman and then the next one would be a 12 and a half and then the next one might be 11:40 and then the next one might be 12:10. Like I'd be missing all those little baby steps and all that little knowledge about mm-hmm. what works for me with training that I would just be surviving mm-hmm. each race instead of learning how to race it and learning how to get the most out of my body. So
now, obviously there are people who want to do one and done and there's no judgment if that's what they want. Mm. Right. But I think there seems to be a lot of,
this is just my approach. But, and this is why, you know, people give me static about, I mean, this is how I'm going to come across always when I say like, I want to race it because mm-hmm. I want to see what my body is capable of. And I want to see people get to the depths of their soul.
But
and
for some
question
people,
if they can keep going,
just finishing that Ironman is that mm-hmm. just, and that because, well, for many different reasons, right? So it's not, I think if people want to do a one and done, that's fine. But a lot of people on your channel are expressing that they want to do this. They want this to be part of their life, that they admire the fact that you literally train every day. It's not I got to drag myself to the gym and lift some weights. It's like you have a training plan. You are always on a training plan of some sort. And they want that lifestyle too. But it's going to be much harder to get to that lifestyle, to really integrate it, when you don't, like you said, take the baby steps. Try a couple of sprints and then try an Olympic and then try a half and then do your full is kind of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Build up a base, build up some endurance, build up some speed, learn your body, learn your nutritional needs, learn what's going to be an injury point for you, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, kind of go at it that way. Mm-hmm. Cause you know, I've watched your progression. I remember watching you do Olympics and you would be destroyed, you know, after the race. You'd look terrible. You were beat down. You know, you could hardly speak on the ride home. You were so tired and so hungry.
Yeah. The second Olympic I did when I was just, I went from sprint to Olympic, bam, 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 bam. and I did a 253 mm-hmm. that day that you're thinking of in Clear Lake.
Yeah. And then we rode home and you were
shattered.
Yeah.
For weeks.
Yeah. And right. But now, you know, you went on training rides in that heat in Kona, rides and runs, and you came back and I thought, oh boy, you're going to be a mess. And you weren't at all. You looked great.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
you've trained up to it.
Trained
and that's
up
the whole
to it.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the flip side of all that, this is where I say Ironman is doing a fantastic thing, sucking all the people out of the grassroots. Holy shit, is that motivating?
Mm. Oh, sure
like,
it is.
My God, do they put on a good show, whether it's Campeche or Campeche or Austin or Kona. My God, is it motivating to see the people that go into it and how they announce it? And every time you go to an Ironman branded race, you know you're getting an awesome race. You're not mm-hmm. going to get bullshit that happens in grassroots level events mm-hmm. where maybe the course
isn't marked. The run
course
isn't properly marked.
I ended up in cornfields one year yep. at one local race because there weren't volunteers on the course yet to guide me to where I went. So I took a left when I should have taken a right. That ain't going to happen. You're going to get a fantastic mm-hmm. experience. You're going to get an expo. You're going to have swag. You're going to have people announcing you. And that motivation, I think, is also part of what can keep people in the sport and draw more people into mm-hmm. the sport. So, I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword that on the one hand, I think it's sucking people out of what makes it a lifestyle mm-hmm. for people. But it is also probably one of the biggest motivators that our sport has.
But I would hazard to say that amazing feeling of crossing the finish line, you're going to feel that when you complete a sprint too, especially if it's one of your first races. You know, it doesn't have to be the biggest game in town to feel amazing and to feel accomplished, right? If I ever did a sprint, oh my God, there'd be crying at the finish line, let me tell you.
Well, we'd have to rebrand the entire channel. You're not NTK anymore.
Well, there
you
go. So I guess I can't ever. But you know, you know what I'm saying? Like that would be a major accomplishment. And still is. So I it's too bad every time I look through the comments on the YouTube channel that people are saying, oh, signed up for my first ever race and it's full Ironman this. It's like, oh, that's, I don't know. I feel like, that's too bad.
You know what? I don't actually feel bad for that because it all depends on, I don't think it's a too bad, depending on how they enter it with their mindset. Mm. The thing that gets me is when people say that, they say to me, you know what, Taryn, it's time that you did a full Ironman. So we saw that you were totally committed to the sport. Yeah. Well,
if they don't see you every single day of the week of every single day of the year training as, and, you know, working on getting faster and better and learning stuff and researching, if they don't see that as committed, then they can just,
Yeah. Well, you know, it's also a thing like, I also know that my commitment is, yes, I want to race Kona one day. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's not going to happen just from going and bashing out the next race being a full Ironman.
Right.
And
yeah.
I know that it's going to take me probably 3-4 years and probably stepping up a couple of age groups before I'm in the age group of 30 to 34. It's like a bunch of ex-pros mm-hmm. that are in that age group. I've got to build up speed and stay healthy for probably 3-5 years.
And then you can beat Oliver from Ireland.
Oliver from Ireland. Oh, he's fast. But I think that's what it's going to take to do it. And when people say, hey, we need to see your commitment, go do a full Ironman. Well, I'm gonna, mm-hmm. but I want to do it right.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to race it.
Yeah. Cause a daily video showcasing your training is no commitment at all.
No, exactly.
Just people.
Yeah.
So just back to the race for a second. Obviously we were mm-hmm. in America. We were in the States, Hawaii, of course. And the top American on the course was Andy Potts.
Mm-hmm.
For
the zillionth time, he's the top American.
Yeah, and Tim O'Donnell fared okay. Jesse Thomas fared all right.
Jesse Thomas did not fare all right.
Okay.
Jesse Thomas had a tough day.
Okay. Jesse Thomas was, I like his hair though. He's got great hair.
He's got good hair.
Dave Scott had said in another interview that it's US that has the depth in triathlon.
He said that actually, she read my notes there and I did not give her very good notes. He does not have the depth in that US does not actually have very good depth in triathlon.
Garbage notes you gave me on that.
They were notes to myself, as a matter of fact.
So garbage notes.
So what Dave Scott is seeing that he's commenting on is that it's been so long since we've seen an American on top of the podium in Kona on the men's or the women's side. it's like consistently Germany, Australia, New Zealand, and the occasional US athlete that gets in there on top of the on the podium, but nobody has been on top. And what Dave Scott said last week is that we just don't have the the US, we're Canadian, our friends from across the border don't have the youth programs that they have in Australia. I believe in Australia, to graduate high school, to get your gym grade, you need to have completed a triathlon.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Whereas in the States, apparently they're even doing away with gym as a course.
Phys ed.
So you're getting a lot of athletes that may be track athletes, might be swimmers, and you have like, say, a Gwen Jorgensen, who would be the exception. But her story is that she was a phenomenal track athlete, or I think she was a swimmer first. Phenomenal swimmer, and then kind of started going through the college ranks as a swimmer, realized that she wasn't going to be an Olympian. So then she became a track athlete. I think it was that way, or conversely, the other way. And she wasn't going to go to the Olympics as a track athlete, but she was pretty good in both of them. And somebody said, well, you know what, maybe because you're okay in these two, you could pick up biking, learn how to bike, and then be a triathlete. And she's a phenomenal triathlete. But it's like triathlon in the US is getting the leftovers of other sports. So, you know, are we going to be able to see a US athlete atop the podium? I don't know. Like Heather Jackson was on the women's side, was that hopeful this year, and she placed fourth.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was people from abroad that made it on top of the podium on the women's side and the men's side.
Canadian Lionel Sanders.
Canadian Lionel Sanders. But yeah, I mean, like, say again, speaking to it from the curling standpoint, what we're finding in Canada is we're still on top of the podium in the world, but it's always been left up to the curlers to figure it out and to get on top of the podium. There isn't a very big high performance development program. And over the last 10 years, we've found consistently that other countries
knocking at the door.
And we went from being dominant, like at Worlds, it was Canada was consistently the gold medal winner. Now it's like Canada, Sweden, Canada, Norway, Canada,
Scotland,
and they're starting to chip away at that. And it is those countries that are actually putting money and a development program into curling that is kind of knocking us off of our high horse. The only reason that we're still up there is because the amount of curlers that we have here is like 100 times that of any other country. So just by nature, we're going to have better curlers because we've got a bigger pool.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of that on a per capita basis of how few people in other places they have to pull from, and they're coming to our exact level by being intentional about it, I think that you need to, like, that's kind of where the United States is. They have more triathletes than anywhere else in the world.
Mm.
But even with that, they're not on top. So I think you need a development program. Maybe it's an Ironman development program. Maybe it's a youth triathlon program.
Maybe you don't take phys ed out of school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that. But that's what Dave Scott said, that you need to develop tougher, more sports-oriented kids earlier on and develop them into triathletes.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Very.
Well, let's
bring it full circle here.
Full circle to good old Jan Frodeno.
Mm-hmm. That was a good story. For anyone that didn't see the day, Jan Frodeno, he biked with the super bikers, came off the bike, I want to say in fourth. And I was in transition with a camera watching everyone come off the bike. And all of a sudden I see Jan whipping around the corner right in behind Cameron Wirth and Sebastian Keenley and Lionel Sanders. And he's not that kind of biker. He's a good biker. He's not the best biker, but he can hold his own. And then all of a sudden I see him coming out of the tent, having changed into his run gear, And all of a sudden he's walking. About, I think it was maybe 6 or 7 miles later, he's on the ground with a locked up back, and he had a back spasm that was so bad that he had to lie on the ground for 10 minutes to stretch it out, and his race was done. But he still, well, we'll pull up the time here. He still did, I think he placed 20th overall. Here, we'll go find old Jan. Can you pick up the story here while I look for the time?
It was a hot and humid day in Kona. The sun was bright in the sky, not a cloud to hide behind. anyway, yeah, Jan was in a considerable amount of pain. In fact, when the reports started coming in, something's happened to Jan. People thought he had actually dropped out of the race. That was kind of the rumor that was going around that he had stopped. In fact, he hadn't. As you mentioned, he did lay down to kind of deal with that back spasm, but then he was walking, and he was going to continue walking the course. And I mean, you had to feel for the poor guy. He was clearly not doing well, but he kept on moving, which was just truly, truly amazing. And, you know, as we were at the finish line, all of a sudden you hear this roar coming from the crowd, and there's Jan kind of running up the finish chute. And it was, I felt so sad for him when he crossed the finish line. He just gave this gigantic shrug like, well, I guess I did it. It was, I felt awful for the guy. Yeah. But anyway, I mean, that's amazing to me that he did finish after all that he kept on going. I mean, good for you. For the guy who was pegged to be the winner, to ending, you know, laying on the ground and still finishes 20th, which goes to show you
35th.
Something.
Oh, 35th. I've got it here. 35th, but in 9 hours, 15 minutes.
Unreal.
Like, just still take a 10-minute nap in the middle, and you still finish 35th in the world.
Well, he was fresh.
Yeah.
He had a nap. He was fresh.
Yeah, it's part of his taper process. Yeah. It was a testament to the amount of respect that I believe people have for Kona, that you have athletes that took a spot from another athlete to race in the most important race our sport has to offer. Some of the announcers out there said that you owe it to that course and that race and your competitors to finish and not just take it out.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you're injured, he was injured. I think that goes a little far. If you're injured, I don't think you owe it to anybody. You owe it to your body to do what's right for your body.
Yeah.
I think that's a bit of an overstatement. You owe it to the course to finish. Well, come on. If you're hurt, you're hurt.
Yeah, that might be strong, but I say that it's a sign of respect. A big sign of respect.
Well, sure. And I mean, did he finish because he respected the course, or did he finish because he's a hell of a competitor and he felt he could still move, so he still moved?
I think it's also part of the camaraderie. You look at, say, Jesse Thomas. He talked after the event. If you don't follow Jesse Thomas, go follow him on Instagram.
Yeah.
Look at the day after or the afternoon of that race. And he did four minute long posts, video posts on Instagram talking about the hard day. And he really started choking up in post number 3, where he was talking about how he would be walking and everyone who was passing him, all of his competitors who are out there, like they're supposed to be his opponents, they would stop and try to get him running with them. Hmm. And be like, come on, Jesse, like run to the next aid station with me. And I think like that, along with Jan still continuing on and doing what he can, is a sign of respect to your competitors. And
I don't know. I more see it as this is the kind of people who do this sport. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's, I mean, now you're the triathlete and I'm not, so I'm just speaking from what I see and what I saw out there. But again, I don't know that it's like, oh, it's Kona, so I respect it and I have to finish. I mean, I just think that's who Jan is. He was not going to let this back spasm and whatever other problems he had beat him, that these other athletes, that they're good enough to say, yes, we're going to bring you along, Jesse. We're going to help you out. I don't know. Is that because they respect Jesse, or is that because this is just who the kind of people that get into this sport? I that's more what I see, and less about just this, well, we respect it, so we're going to have to help. I don't know.
That's a tough call, because there were also Michelle Vesterby and I think it was Alicia Kay that pulled out of the race. And
does that mean they don't respect the course? They don't respect their competitors? I think that just meant that they had to respect their own bodies. I mean, that has to come first, right?
Look down at them for having to pull out. I don't know. I would say that it's an ultimate badass move to continue on.
Oh, for sure it is. I mean, Jan, that's, how could you not respect a guy like that? He's a neat personality to begin with. He's a cool and entertaining guy, but to see him do that, now that's like, okay. You know, if you had never watched the sport and that's the first taste of it you got, you're going to remember that guy. You're going to root for that guy.
Yeah. And that's also, you know, at Jan's level, he's looked at under a microscope and the entire world is looking at him. And if he can't motivate people to be the best athlete that they can by winning the race, he still has the opportunity to motivate people to be the best athlete they can, even with a back spasm, to still finish the race.
Yeah.
And that kind of comes around full circle to what I was saying of doing the most that you possibly can, bringing your body to the brink of its capabilities and continuing on.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of comes around to that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Kona 2017.
That is Kona 2017. Yeah. Thank you all, Trainiacs, for listening, watching on YouTube. I'll say that it was kind of funny while we were there that in the first couple of days when I would reach out to people who have been in the sport, whether it was announcers or media people or business people, about getting an interview with them or a little bit of time for a meeting, they would say, well, you know, who are you? Can you talk a little bit about, you know, this triathlon Terran community?
Yeah,
who are you? What do you want? And then when we would start actually talking to them, or they would look at my channel, or companies that have actually reached out to me since Kona, who had watched the coverage, and they're seeing the comments and the amount of views and the amount of people that follow, it was kind of like a triathlon Terran Trainiac community coming out party. And
yeah, because it's not just that you have subscribers and views on the videos. It's that people are commenting and having discussions and, every single day.
And these business people, these commenters, before they reach out to people like me, I've heard them say that they read those comments. Like they want to make sure that I haven't gone and bought 23,000 followers, and they go and they look at the comments and they look at the engagement and they see, wow, you have a really cool community of people that are not just into what you're doing, but you're helping them get into their own transformation stories. And as much as it's cool to go there and be the media person and Triathlon Terran and take selfies with people, the only reason that we're able to do that is because all of you take the time out of your day to listen and follow and reach out to us. And thank you all.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool how many people came up to you randomly in Kona from around the world to say, hey, I'm a Trainiac. Identifying themselves as such. I think that, or people running past, where were we? We were on Ali'i Drive and some cyclist, hey, Triathlon Terran. I mean, yeah. I don't know how she could even see you. She was going so fast past, but,
she recognized my nipples.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. My nipples are the most famous nipples on YouTube. I think.
You and the running shirtless.
Mm-hmm.
That was touching. That was pretty neat. And, validating that all the effort of doing videos every single day, which cuts into our actual life, that it is, it's getting out there. It's reaching people around the world, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah. And with that, I'll say, if you are in Austin and you see me and you have that little bit of like, well, should I say hi or should I not? Maybe he doesn't want to be bothered. No, I want to be bothered very much.
Yeah.
Because that is the absolute coolest part of getting out of Winnipeg and going to Interbike or Kona or Austin, that when I get to meet people.
Is meeting the people that you're doing this for.
Yeah. And it also, like, it feels like we're part of a team. And just up here in Winnipeg, like Coach Pat and all the gang, they're like, Terran, he's got the camera again. Like they're so unimpressed with it by now that it's like just another thing, that it's not a novelty to them anymore. So getting
or like
to
when
connect,
you whip out the camera at dinner when we're having dinner.
Well, and now being able to connect with people abroad who I don't know, that's what kind of makes it real.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it just feels like talking to a camera, which is an inanimate object, but to know that there are other people all around the world that are tuning in, it's cool. So
Indeed.
That is all. Thank you.
You're giving him a reason to live, people.
Feed my ego. Thank you, Trainiacs.
See ya.
Hey, Trainiacs, I hope you dug that interview. Just a few things before you take off and get onto your next podcast. First off, if you want to get just the best Triathlon Terran stuff filtered for you every week, go to triathlonterran.com/the hits. Enter your email address, and every week, instead of having to sift through all the bad stuff to get to the good, we'll send you out a weekly email with our most popular YouTube video from the previous week, Instagram posts, spotting a podcast, or even some of the favorite gear that I'm trying out. Could be a book, could be some tech, whatever. If you enter your email address, we'll make it easy for you. Get to your best stuff every week by going to triathlonterran.com/the hits.
And next, if you want to support the show at all, you can go to triathlonterran.com and take your pick from a few things we've got there that you can work into your day-to-day training. We've got coaching plans if you are looking for one. We've got our awesome-looking Trainiac gear. And if you click through the Amazon banner ad or click on any of the products that we mention or link to and you purchase anything at one of the affiliate sites like Amazon, it doesn't cost you anything extra, but we get a small commission. And of course, everything adds up and helps us a lot to keep this thing going.
And finally, if you want to get a shout out personally for your family members, Tri Club, whatever you want, leave a rating for us over on iTunes, good, bad, whatever. And in the next podcast, we'll shout out everyone who in the previous week gave us an iTunes podcast rating. That really helps us get discovered there. And if you want to give a shout out to anyone specifically, share the podcast with someone and CC me in at Taren, T-A-R-E-N, at triathlonterran.com, and send us the message that you want to send to your loved one, friend, family member, most hated nemesis out on the tri course, whatever it is.